Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm the former military officer, Ray Powell. He's the former diplomat, Jim Caruso. He's got the brains, I've got the looks. So let's chat about this century's most dynamic region with yet another brilliant guest. Jim, remember how last time we talked, I was back in the U.S.? That was fun.
Well, you know, it's nice to have you touch down every so often, and now you're back in Manila. And clearly, since both Hanscom and I have glasses and you think you're the best looking one here, you might want to look into a pair of specs. In any case, and hearing aids. In any case, I'm very pleased to welcome another former diplomat, an old colleague of mine, Hanscom Smith. Hanscom had a long, distinguished career as a diplomat with the U.S. State Department, culminating in as being consul general in Hong Kong. And now he's associated with Yale and Center for Strategic International Studies, the last redoubt of former diplomats. So Hanscom, welcome. Glad to have you on with us. And we're going to launch right at you and ask you the question, why should anyone care about the future of Hong Kong? It's already been absorbed by China. It's a lost cause.
Great. Well, Ray and Jim, thank you both very much. Good to be with you. And it's so important, I think, to discuss Hong Kong and to understand Hong Kong on many fronts. First of all, because of Hong Kongers themselves. Many people have left Hong Kong over the last several years for a variety of reasons, but the vast majority of Hong Kongers are staying there. And their city is very different from the Hong Kong that existed before 2019. I think we should care about Hong Kong, first of all, because Hong Kong's status is international. In preparation for the return of Hong Kong's sovereignty to China, the United Kingdom and mainland China agreed on its status. And the Sino-British Joint Declaration is an international treaty that's registered in the United Nations. So Hong Kong is part of China, but it's also a very international city in which the United States and many other foreign partners played a really key role in helping to support the viability of what in 1997 was a new concept, one country, two systems. Hong Kong, part of China, but maintaining by treaty a high degree of autonomy for 50 years after the resumption of mainland China's sovereignty. So Hong Kong status is international. Hong Kongers themselves are important, naturally. And then from an American perspective, we have huge interests in Hong Kong. There is a massive American community resident in Hong Kong. It's one of the biggest overseas U.S. communities in the world. The statistics have shifted, but I believe the latest puts it at over 80,000 Americans. And it's also one of our biggest trading relationships. It's one of our biggest, if not the single biggest, trade surpluses we run anywhere in the world, over $20 billion. So finally, I think that in an era of questioning of the economic model and the consensus that prevailed after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, about the relationship between political pluralism and economic development, Hong Kong is a vital litmus test. Hong Kong is the most developed, richest part of China. And in the past, the assumption was that Hong Kong's openness and development would be a model for the mainland's evolution. Hong Kong, in many ways, remains an extremely successful economy. I would argue, however, that the changes over the last several years make it less competitive and, unfortunately, a less certain economic destination. And that has implications for all of Hong Kong's partners, and I think also implications for where the mainland is going to go. Hong Kong is a developed international services hub, and the mainland isn't. So the broader implications of the model and the relationship between political pluralism and openness and economic development, I think, are also key when we talk about Hong Kong.
So Hanscom, you talked about one country, two systems. And I think for those of us who watch from a distance, we sort of just looked at what happened in 2019 and said, well, that's over. To what extent is it still two systems? And does Beijing expect it to remain to whatever extent two systems, or, you know, or is it over, or will it soon be over?
Hong Kong's autonomy has been eroded since 2019, but that doesn't mean that it is the same as mainland China. And I think that's a very important point to make. My most recent visit to Hong Kong was in May, a few months ago, where I was able to spend a week there. So Hong Kong continues to have a very different economic system from mainland China. It's much more open economically. The biggest change since 2019 has been the erosion of political and social autonomy. So civil society, the political opposition are no longer as vibrant, or in many cases have been constrained. There are serious concerns about certainty related to judicial independence and the rule of law that had always been one of Hong Kong's strongest calling cards. So it's definitely not the Hong Kong that we saw before 2019. However, despite all of the significant setbacks, it also remains a very different environment than the mainland. For example, Hong Kong's internet remains open. You can go to Hong Kong and use social media, international social media. You can log on to international news outlets. Freedom of religion is much more respected in many ways in Hong Kong than I think it is on the mainland. And while press freedom has suffered some significant setbacks in recent years, the media environment remains more open than the mainland. This is all relative. I don't want to suggest that everything is perfect. I just want to make the point that Hong Kong remains different from the mainland, despite many of the serious problems that we've seen.
You know, many of us comforted ourselves in 2019 with the idea that China wouldn't want to kill the golden goose of Hong Kong. It was too important economically. But I think what we're seeing is President Xi values control over economic growth greatly. And I think we're seeing as a result of that, that a lot of businesses are leaving Hong Kong. A lot of Chinese money that was in Hong Kong is leaving the country. And if I'm a businessman, and you mentioned judicial independence is not what it was, if I can't trust rule of law, do I really want to invest in Hong Kong? I might as well invest in China. So what's your outlook for going forward with the business community?
So I think that's also a very key point to look at in more detail, Jim, because when I talk to many friends outside of Hong Kong, the assumption is that international businesses have been fleeing Hong Kong in droves. And in practice, that's not the case. I think there has been an ongoing erosion of Hong Kong's competitiveness as a hub for decades, frankly. And some of that may have been accelerated, particularly because of the very strict COVID restrictions, in addition to the political instability and uncertainty and things like the rule of law. But relatively few major firms are actually leaving Hong Kong. There are still over, I believe, 1,200 American businesses in Hong Kong, and 250 or so of those use Hong Kong as their regional hub. You've certainly seen incrementally a greater mainland business presence in Hong Kong. Hong Kong's economy, compared to a couple of decades ago, is relatively less diverse. So in the past, you saw Hong Kong playing a relatively greater role in as a port, logistics, also culturally. Some of us remember when the Hong Kong film industry was more dominant regionally. Now you have an economy that is increasingly dominated by finance. And even with the setbacks of recent years, there really is not a hub that can vie with Hong Kong as a platform with the talent pool for servicing the mainland as a financial hub. And certainly when I left Hong Kong 2 years ago, even in the midst of the COVID restrictions, many major U.S. financial firms were actually expanding their presence in Hong Kong to take advantage of opportunities on the mainland.
You recently wrote a piece that suggested strongly that the U.S. And the West should treat Hong Kong differently than it treats the mainland because it's in our interest to do so, that it's important that we play a role in trying to keep Hong Kong as different as possible or as perhaps as international as possible. I guess the question is, how does that work? I mean, it seems like, you know, again, to an outsider, it would seem like Xi Jinping ultimately is the one who gets to decide how international Hong Kong is going to be. And what does it matter how the West, you know, treats Hong Kong if in the end we don't get to make the choice?
Sure. So Hong Kong, and by everyone, I mean China and the United Kingdom, with support from the U.S. and much of the rest of the international community, signed up for a high degree of autonomy. Hong Kong has lost a great deal, but not all of that autonomy. I don't see how it benefits Hong Kongers to preemptively start treating Hong Kong like the mainland. And your question, Ray, is what does that mean practically for America and for Hong Kong's other friends? First of all, I think that means for Hong Kongers who are interested in other opportunities, the U.S. has to do more to provide safe havens. The United Kingdom, as well as Canada and Australia, have programs. The U.S. Has taken some steps to help Hong Kongers who are already here, but I think that's one important show of support. But we also have to remember that the vast majority of Hong Kongers are going to stay in Hong Kong. What can we do for them? And the government ties have suffered for a variety of reasons, but people-to-people ties, particularly education, are really important. We should restore things like Fulbright. We should work to foster more links between U.S. universities and their Hong Kong counterparts, get more Hong Kongers studying here and more Americans who are studying in Hong Kong. Those types of the practical steps, while individually they may seem relatively small bore, in fact, add up, I think, to a show of support to help Hong Kong try to hold on to what's left and ultimately regain that sense of autonomy and the international status that it enjoyed before 2019.
All right, so there's still some autonomy, but it's certainly not in the political realm. It's more in sort of the finance realm and some of the media, as you mentioned. Although I noticed the South China Morning Post is a lot more careful than it used to be. If I'm in Taiwan, what lessons do I take from the absorption of Hong Kong? Does it say I can live with this, or does it say this is a nightmare I have to avoid at all costs?
Well, there was a time when I think there was some interest in advancing something like one country, two systems as a potential option for Taiwan. That wasn't necessarily something that was widely held on Taiwan, but at least on the mainland. I think the treatment of Hong Kong, of course, has been seen as something that's very troubling to many of the mainland's partners. And it's, as I said, it's a broader question about how an international agreement is handled. And it's ironic because when I've talked to people who were involved in those negotiations decades ago, the fact that the agreement is registered at the United Nations was, according to my information, in large part at the insistence of China, because at the time they were worried about backtracking by the UK. Ironically, decades later, China that's been publicly more dismissive of the status. And yes, China or Hong Kong is part of China. We can't dispute that. But its status after 1997 is the subject of an international agreement. And the way that has been handled, particularly through the imposition of the national security law in 2020, is troubling.
So, okay, so there's an international agreement. I guess, you know, to many of us, we sort of looked at 2019 as the abrogation of the agreement. So are you saying that, I mean, in that there are there any mechanisms within the agreement or within the structure of the agreement where China can still be influenced to treat Hong Kong somehow better? How does that all work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, exactly. That's the challenge. I mean, what is the leverage for the international community? I think, and I've said this many times before publicly, the scope and the vehemence of the 2019 protest movement caught everyone by surprise. Beijing, I think Hong Kong itself, and Hong Kong's friends, including the United States. I think that, first of all, it was not a single united protest movement. And I think they are now, the protests are characterized retrospectively. If you read almost any Western media report, they're characterized by the shorthand of pro-democracy protests. And I think it's important to dig under the surface a little bit to figure out, well, what exactly does that mean? I would say, and I arrived, I should say, in Hong Kong in July of 2019 as the protests were really getting underway. That this was ultimately a movement largely driven by a desire for accountability. People wanted their government to be accountable, to be responsive to their needs, and they were growing increasingly uneasy about the dynamic or the balance between mainland influence and the autonomy they were promised. And what's happened retrospectively, I think, is that there's a shorthand of pro-democracy. And at least on the mainland, there are many people who mistakenly think that the protests were driven by a desire not for accountability or even autonomy, but for Hong Kong independence, which, in my view, simply wasn't the case. You know, I look back now, and I think the first week I arrived in Hong Kong in July of 2019, I got together with some of my Hong Kong friends. And they said, Hanscom, you've got to, Carrie Lam was the chief executive of Hong Kong at the time. And they said, Hanscom, you've got to do a photo op with Carrie Lam and McDonald's. Anything to try to help, you know, make her seem approachable. Of course, that wasn't I think they were half joking, but I think they were half serious. And that was one of, you know, many impressionistic indicators I got as a newcomer to Hong Kong myself. That this was largely about government accountability.
Okay, so the protests, the reaction seemed to be, it wasn't about accountability, it was about control and concern about independence movement or separation of some sort from Beijing. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I believe, and I have, you know, asked many people for their analysis and their own impressions, because the official propaganda reaction from the mainland and also the reaction from many in Hong Kong was, and you often hear this word, foreign forces. And in the context of a very tense relationship between the United States and the mainland at the time, I think there were many people who were convinced that somehow the United States was, in their words, trying to play a Hong Kong card and stir things up and use Hong Kong as a pawn. This was the analysis. Many people chose to connect the dots that way as part of a conspiracy theory. And it, of course, that dismisses the views of, you know, the hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers who were protesting, the vast majority of them, peacefully. You know, this was an organic political problem that emanated from within Hong Kong. So I'll go back to the propaganda line that this was actually a quote unquote color revolution fomented by the United States. And it's one thing if that's the propaganda, which is a problem because it's not true, but it's also an issue whether or not, not just that it's a propaganda, but do people believe it? Do key people in Beijing think that that's really the case? And I don't think everyone believed that, but I think based on my understanding, a lot of key people did. So if your strong belief is that that's really what's happening on the ground, and we tried strenuously, publicly and privately, to refute that, but in an atmosphere of distrust and bilateral tension, it became really difficult to overcome. So you had, as I said, people who were just startled by the scope and the vehemence of the protests. I think a reaction that, okay, there must be something afoot, manipulated by quote unquote foreign forces. And the response, as you said, Jim, was largely driven by a desire for political control. You see a huge rhetorical emphasis on national security. Without that, I think, actually being clearly defined, a lot of emphasis on stability. Again, without that, I think a very different idea of what we would here in the United States describe as stability, and also a huge focus on patriotism, and all from a very different perspective and a very different approach than what those words would mean, I think, to us as Americans.
So Hanscom, from, you know, speaking of tension and distrust, you know, the U.S.-China relationship continues, of course, down that road. And for those of us who are, you know, you end up in the security space a lot, I think, you know, we look at these things with a more jaundiced eye, right? And so we look at if, you know, treating Hong Kong as if it's still the same international city, or at least close to the same international city it was before, sounds almost like maybe we're enabling China, or sort of letting it have its cake and eat it too by removing the some of the political autonomy and yet still giving it that financial or you know, those other benefits. And, you know, so tell me why that's the wrong way to look at this. I'm all ears. Yeah,
sure. Well, first of all, back in the 1990s, Congress passed something called the Hong Kong Policy Act, and that was the legal framework for the United States to help support one country, two systems. By treating Hong Kong differently, that would help make it different. Now, in the wake of the imposition of the national security law in 2020, under the Hong Kong Policy Act, the United States, I think, understandably, removed a lot of the different areas of differential treatment. Not all of them, but many of them. And so it's not correct to say that there hasn't been a policy response in the U.S. treatment of Hong Kong after 2020 is different from before under the Hong Kong Policy Act. But I think you have to draw a distinction between the Hong Kong government and the central government in Beijing and Hong Kongers themselves. And so that's why I think it's important to engage in the ways that I spoke of before through educational, cultural, civil society, and yes, business ties. Hong Kong remains a very important hub, and a lot of the things that are important to international businesses, American businesses, like the free flow of information, transparency, the rule of law, accountability, yes, those are business values, but they're a key part of what was always a successful Hong Kong model.
All right. I would still argue that some of those key aspects are being at least eroded, if not gone. But even more importantly, I would say that given that Hong Kong's main purpose is as sort of a gateway into China without being in the mainland, and the Chinese economy apparently being in quite serious trouble. Does Hong Kong's economy going forward look more problematic? I know I sort of asked you this, but it just seems to me that if the Chinese economy slows to 2-3% growth going forward or less, what happens to Hong Kong?
Right. And so, as I said, the evolution of Hong Kong's economy over the last couple of decades, or certainly since 1997, is that it's become relatively less diverse. So it's become more dominated by finance in particular, and also tourism and mainland tourism in particular, and spending. And it's become relatively less of a global and regional hub and more of a base for doing business in China. And so that's all great when China is booming. With mainland China slowing down, yes, I think that probably prompts a bit of a rethink for many in Hong Kong. When you talk to certain Hong Kong policymakers about Hong Kong's economic future, the inevitable phrase that you hear is the Greater Bay Area Initiative. And that's looking at the major mainland cities in the Pearl River Delta as a source of future growth and economic integration and synergy. I think that a lot of that presumably would be happening organically. It's a phrase, it's a plan. I think that there are a lot of different undertones to the Greater Bay Area. But while I found when I was on the ground that many businesses were interested, I think they were also uncertain about some of the practical aspects of how it was going to work and whether or not the strengths that they saw in Hong Kong, which were already under duress for a variety of reasons, were going to be translated into engagement in the Greater Bay Area. What Hong Kong, I think, confronts now is much less certainty about many of its strengths. People could always count on, for example, the transparency, the rule of law, the impartiality. I think that there are few, if any, major businesses who have actually practically confronted problems in those areas. What has changed instead is the confidence that that's going to continue to be the case, in addition to the slowdown and growth in the mainland.
So on that, do you have confidence that that's going to continue to be the case? And how far out does that confidence go? I mean, do you believe that in the central part of the Chinese Communist Party, where they're looking down the road at what, 20 years from now, Hong Kong looks like, does it look more like mainland China, or does it continue to look like Hong Kong circa 2024?
I think that's the key question, because as I said, Hong Kong, for all of its challenges, is so much more developed than the mainland still, particularly or including in services. And the goal was always that, okay, the mainland is going to learn from Hong Kong. And now you see Hong Kong in some ways, denigrated or maybe overlooked. A lot of these attributes are the openness that I believe is ultimately the best guarantor of stability is now derided by many as a source of instability. And so this goes back to the fundamental model of how do you develop? And I think a key point is that when you look at the world's most developed economies, they all have a high degree of political pluralism with very, very few exceptions. And how is the mainland going to evolve economically? Is the mainland going to become more open? So Hong Kong, I think, needs to restore its luster. And I think a lot of that means recognition of the fact that you can't erode the political and the social autonomy and expect that it's not going to bleed into Hong Kong's economic competitiveness as well. I've also said this many times, you can't have one country and two economic and financial systems and not pay attention to autonomy in the political and civil society fields as well.
The other risk is the one thing all of Washington's united about is the competition with China and how much harder we have to be one way or the other. And the risk for Hong Kong, of course, is a transshipment point as a financier of China. Things could get hotter for Hong Kong as far as U.S. policies are concerned. Do you see that coming from your discussions in Washington?
Do I see Hong Kong, that coordination with Hong Kong on things like countering international crime and that type of cooperation?
Well, and just in general, Hong Kong being lumped in with mainland as a source of finance for Chinese weapons manufacturers shipping to Ukraine, to Russia, rather.
Yeah. I do think that when you look at Hong Kong's residual autonomy, a lot of it lies in the financial and the economic realms. And certainly my own experience in Hong Kong was that despite a very challenging political environment, there was still a great deal of important cooperation and understanding on countering international crime and illicit financial flows. And so those are the kinds of things that we need to try to maintain, as difficult as it is. And as I said before, if you continue to chip away at autonomy on all fronts, all of these areas are ultimately quite linked, and you can't maintain the integrity of different aspects of Hong Kong's systems on one end if you don't have the political and civil society autonomy to back them up.
So Hanscom, I want to just, you talked about your experience in Hong Kong a couple of times, and it's really sort of fascinating that you arrived there just as all of the 2019 excitement was beginning. What was that like? You had obviously a very key role there as the chief diplomat, America's chief diplomat, and the overseer of, American interests, American citizens, American businesses. Yeah. Did you get much sleep? How did that period of time go for you?
Do you have a yellow umbrella?
Sorry?
Do you have a yellow umbrella?
Yeah. So the I think what was really first of all, I should say that Hong Kong is traditionally the very nice place you go after you've been through a challenging other assignment, and that no one was really into. I thought that I was going to be spending my time promoting American business and educational exchange and those sorts of things. And Hong Kong was, and in many ways still is, an extremely comfortable place. And unlike many other hubs, people stay there not just for years, expats, but for decades. And so you have this massive American community, many of them who had been there for 20 or 30 years. Hong Kong hadn't really been on the radar screen. The One Country, Two Systems certainly had its challenges, but it had become part of the landscape. And I don't think that the policy community was focused on Hong Kong. As I said, I don't think people were expecting the protest movement to be so large and to turn out the way that it did. So when I arrived, and you look at many people on the ground, there was a sense of maybe confusion, misunderstanding, in some cases denial. This is not the Hong Kong that I expected, or it's not affecting me personally. So sometimes people on the ground tended to underreact to what was going on. And then colleagues back in Washington are flipping on a TV set and seeing the most lurid clips of protests and later on in the year violence. They start to overreact. And so I spent a lot of my time working with the consulate team on making certain that we were in touch with the American community, a massive American community. And our first responsibility is always to support them and to maintain their safety. The Hong Kong government was clearly overwhelmed and in crisis. No one knew what was happening. So it was a very uncertain, fluid time. And my job was to get the consulate on a very different footing because the situation had changed dramatically, make certain there was good communication and also trust with Washington so that Washington understood that we were on top of the situation and taking it seriously. And the challenging part as the situation evolved, of course, was to overcome not just the propaganda, but the reality of how people saw our role politically. So it was not the Hong Kong experience that I was I was imagining when I arrived there.
So it's always interested me is your consular district also included Macau.
Yes.
And Macau had nothing. It's all been quiet, no protests. Yes. Just what is? Are the Portuguese that influential that they can say, hey, cool it? Or are Macau people that different from Hong Kongers or what?
Yeah, Macau is a very different place. It had a different, during the Portuguese colonial period, a different legacy, different sort of economy, just a very different profile. I traveled to Macau regularly until the pandemic made that impossible. So unfortunately, after multiple trips in the second half of 2019, after I arrived, I wasn't able to return to Macau because of COVID restrictions. So, of course, we remained in touch virtually. It was difficult to service and support the American community there because it was hard for us to get there on the ground. But Macau should not be forgotten. It also has an unusual format, but that's very different from Hong Kong's. And it's been much more politically peaceful there.
Well, how about as an exit question, since you brought up the pandemic, of course, we all have our pandemic experiences. What was the pandemic like in the early days in Hong Kong?
I think that Hong Kong was especially influenced by its experience as the epicenter of SARS. So they took the pandemic extremely seriously. To the point where I think that in retrospect, they overdid it. So when we saw some of the challenges that many other jurisdictions were having, at least initially, Hong Kong was a COVID-free, a largely COVID-free bubble for much of the pandemic, but at significant cost. There was mandatory inbound quarantine of 3 weeks. I don't think there was no medical basis for a 3 week quarantine. And then non-residents weren't able to visit. So while Hong Kong was very successful initially at great cost in limiting exposure to COVID, I think what happened by the spring of 2022, when vaccines finally became available, unfortunately, there was a great deal of misinformation about the effectiveness of the Pfizer vaccine and alleged side effects. Anyway, what happened was once COVID got in, many of the elderly were not vaccinated. And so Hong Kong briefly had, I think, if not the highest, one of the world's highest COVID death rates. That was extremely difficult. So, many of the measures that the Hong Kong government either took or threatened to not just quarantine, but some other measures were, I think, too aggressive. And a lot of our work was to stay in close coordination with Washington as to what we would and would not accept. And the bottom line for us was no parent-child separation. And we worked very hard to prevent that from happening in the American community. So it's a very tense and divisive issue for many expatriates, certainly within the consulate community. Many people felt that as diplomats, we should not be subject to many of the restrictions. That was not Washington's decision. We had to advocate with Washington. We also had to advocate very strongly with the Hong Kong government and work with our own community. So it was an unusual COVID response that was seen as perhaps at least initially quite effective, but became increasingly a source of tension and frustration for a lot of people in Hong Kong, both just as a on a personal level and also for Hong Kong's viability as a business hub.
Well, on that happy note, we do want to thank you, Malcolm Hanscom-Smith, for being with us. It's been really educational for those of us who haven't spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. I myself have only been through the airport, and given my current, the way that the government in Beijing currently looks at me, I probably will not go through that airport anymore, just out of personal precautions. So probably shouldn't look at it that way. But, you know, if there's a 1% chance, that feels like that I could just sort of end up as a long-term guest of the our friends in China, that seems like maybe a prudent way for me to go. So, but anyway, Hanscom-Smith, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to have you on again.
So it is now several weeks after our original interview with Hanscom-Smith, former Consul General to Hong Kong. And in that time, there's been news, and Hanscom's been kind enough to return and do a little postscript with us. Hi again, Hanscom.
Hi.
Okay, so here's the news. The news is the State Department has released a business advisory about Hong Kong, the highlights of which are warning people about the broad and vague provisions of the national security law. Business should be aware of the extraterritorial application of the SNS ordinance, SNS being safeguarding national security. Businesses operating in Hong Kong face potential legal, regulatory, operational, financial, and reputational risks, including increased scrutiny, potential financial penalties, and legal actions for any violations of the ordinance of the new security law. And businesses operating in Hong Kong may face conflicting jurisdictional requirements and liability in connection with sanctions compliance efforts. Failure to adhere to U.S. sanctions can result in criminal and civil penalties under U.S. law. Phew, that's a lot of risk we're talking about. And on top of that, there's a bill in the House of Representatives of the U.S. to close Hong Kong trade offices. So Hanscom, can you put this in context for us?
Yes, for the business advisory, this is an update of the original business advisory, which was issued in 2021. And it reflects changes to the legal landscape in Hong Kong, particularly Article 23 national security legislation and the safeguarding national security law. I think the biggest change in Hong Kong is the erosion of the certainty that once characterized the legal system. In the past, I think there was much more confidence about the transparency and predictability of how Hong Kong's rule of law would work. Now, with these national security regulations, one of the key areas is a characterization of external forces and external interference. These are not really clearly defined. And in that context, I think it gives businesses and other people operating in Hong Kong much less certainty. This is more of a rule by law as opposed to rule of law approach. It's what we typically see on the mainland. And the overriding concern is to try to ensure a degree of political control. And the propaganda from Beijing is always that the 2019 protest movement was caused by external forces or foreign forces. That wasn't the case. But if you're operating based on that assertion, then it's not really clear exactly what you're trying to do. And that reduces the clarity for everyone operating in Hong Kong. The upshot is more uncertainty. I don't think that this is necessarily designed to hurt Hong Kong's competitiveness. It's designed to do, the effort is to do two things simultaneously, and that is try to maintain Hong Kong as a services and business hub, while exerting much more political control. Those two goals are, in my view, incompatible and very problematic. Because what you're in fact doing by continuing to erode Hong Kong's autonomy and by eroding the predictability and transparency of the legal system, then you're hurting the city's competitiveness. And that's something that no one wants to see.
So I know it's early days, but have you heard of any actual impact so far in Hong Kong and U.S. businesses or other foreign businesses doing business there?
No. I have not heard of specific instances involving businesses who are running afoul of this. I think that but I do know privately from not just businesses, but also educational institutions, civil society, a lot of people have questions because they don't know whether or not this could apply to them. So that affects their planning. So there are some private concerns, but I haven't heard of any specific cases yet involving an American business.
Do you know if the Hong Kong government is reaching out to foreign businesses in Hong Kong to try and reassure them in any way?
I know that they have in the past. I think the message privately that's been transmitted before is, we don't mean you. In other words, talking to business associations, this isn't going to affect you. And I think that's probably sincere when the assertion is made. I think the problem is because of this fundamental change in Hong Kong's legal system, it's much harder for people to have confidence that that's necessarily going to be the case. As I said, there's much less predictability now in the legal environment.
Well, I think it sounds like it could be used arbitrarily.
There's an obsession with national security and foreign forces or external forces. These concepts are not clearly defined. So that vague nature, and in addition to many of the way we've seen the national security law in particular used since it was imposed in 2020, understandably gives people pause. It's simply not the same legal environments that existed before in Hong Kong.
So the U.S. companies are also clearly caught between a rock and a hard place, since the advisory made very clear if you try to get around any sanctions against Chinese companies, we will find you and hurt you. So American companies are on the track to problems either way if they don't really hew to the straight and narrow. And it might be hard at times.
I know that when I was on the ground in Hong Kong soon after the national security law was imposed, and also in the wake of U.S. sanctions affecting Hong Kong and mainland officials, a lot of American businesses, of course, wanted to do the right thing. They wanted to continue to operate in Hong Kong and not run afoul of course, U.S. law. Or of local legislation. And so there was a great deal of behind the scenes questioning, planning, and as I said, much more uncertainty about the legal environment.
Well, on top of that, now there's a bill in the House, as I mentioned, to close the Hong Kong trade offices. I think there are three in the US. Now, we talked last time about the need to maintain some sort of contact with Hong Kong and continue at least the people-to-people ties. How will this affect the relationship between Hong Kong and U.S. and maintaining some sort of relationship?
So the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Offices have, at least in the past, played a role primarily of promoting economic, but also other exchange, people-to-people and cultural exchange between the United States and Hong Kong. Hong Kong, to the extent that Hong Kong maintains some aspects of the autonomy it used to have before 2019, it's mostly in the economic field. And Hong Kong remains an extremely open economy where the U.S. is very competitive. It is, if not the biggest, one of our biggest bilateral trade surpluses anywhere in the world. And I don't think that the United States needs to get ahead of anyone else, including the mainland, in limiting or undermining the infrastructure of what remains of Hong Kong's autonomy. So I certainly understand what's motivating the concerns about the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Offices. But at the same time, I think it's in our interest, not just in economic terms, but also more broadly in trying to hold on to what's left of Hong Kong's autonomy, to keep the Economic and Trade Offices as part of that infrastructure for autonomy.
Now, they just brought to trial a young man for wearing what they call a seditious T-shirt, which says something like "Freedom for Hong Kong." So this is going to make it even harder as people decry the human rights violations that are implied in that sort of activity. So I hope we can find some way through this, but it's not looking good.
There are, I think, multiple own goals that have been scored by the Hong Kong side on this. And, you know, ultimately, it's a question of, I think, insecurity in the wake of the protest movement, which I think was primarily about simply asking the Hong Kong government to be accountable and asking the Hong Kong government and the central government in Beijing to honor the terms of the Sino-British Joint Declaration promising a high degree of autonomy. That's what people wanted. And that ultimately is the source of stability. And unfortunately, we've seen Beijing and the Hong Kong authorities go in a very different direction that I don't think is, first of all, it's not what the Hong Kong people were promised. It's not what was agreed to. And it's not in Hong Kong's interest.
Okay, well, we'll leave it with that. Trajectory is all wrong, but we need to keep finding the way to try and work with this. Hanscom Smith, thanks again for joining us. We had this episode in lieu of our usual back and forth with Ray. No story today. This story with you, Hanscom, beats any of ours anyway. So thanks again for joining us for Indo-Pacific Podcast. And listen to us on YouTube, whatever your favorite streaming service is. And we'll be back again next week. Thanks again.